Welcome to Poetry Lectures, a series of lectures by poets, scholars, and educators, presented by PoetryFoundation.org. In this program, we hear a conversation with Seamus Heaney. Arguably the most popular poet in Great Britain, Seamus Heaney was born in 1939 in Northern Ireland. He resigned from teaching in 1972 to live with his wife and family in a small cottage and to work full-time as a writer. He later took a part-time teaching position at Harvard, and in 1989 was elected to a 5-year term as professor of poetry at Oxford University. He has received numerous awards, including the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1995. Heaney often writes about life in rural Ireland. His poems sometimes refer to Irish history and conflict, but his work is not overtly political. His work as a translator of early Irish and Anglo-Saxon poetry has also influenced his own poetry. For more insight on Heaney's work, we invited Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine, and Don Scher, Poetry's senior editor, to share their thoughts on Seamus Heaney.
You know, Don, Seamus Heaney represents, I mean, the rarest of phenomena these days of poetry, who has become not simply popular, but sort of, I mean, a rock star figure among poets. You know, I was in England not long ago, and someone was telling me about a survey had been done, and his books were selling, I don't know, 2/3 of every poetry book that sold, or something like that, something crazy. You know, why do you think that is?
The other thing is his readings are real events. I mean, everybody has to come to a Seamus Heaney event. I've thought a lot about this, I think, because I, too, was greatly affected by his work when I was younger, and lines like, "My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog," may sound very particular to a given place, a place in Ireland that, you know, Heaney knows intimately. But he's a perfect example of a poet who's able to take the real particulars of a life, including, you know, getting down in the dirt and what's buried and grown there, and make it universal. I mean, it sounds like a cliche, but he really does this over and over again.
Yeah, it's what people crave in some way.
It really is, and no one's better at it than he is. He's always present in his poems.
Those lines that you quote are from an early poem called Digging, and that poem was actually the first poem, as Seamus Heaney said, that in which he felt his voice, in which he felt some sort of stirrings rise up to make him into a poet. So that's a particularly salient poem for him.
Yeah, and in everything he does, Seamus Heaney is a great teacher, and he's talked a lot about this poem and the experience that you've described, and he talks about the lesson he learned from Patrick Kavanagh. In some ways, this poem owes a lot to Kavanagh's The Great Hunger, where Heaney has said he realized from Kavanagh that you could write a poem about ordinary things, about digging in dirt, about being a farmer, being a bachelor, you know, a certain kind of life that didn't sound like a great subject for a poem really would be a great subject for a poem, is something we learned from Kavanagh and many times over from Heaney.
You'll hear that poem in the program that follows. You might also hear that this is a very obviously early poem for Seamus Heaney. And some of the connections that are made brilliantly. Some are made crudely. He's been criticized for a line in here, "snug as a gun."
Yeah.
Because he loved sound so much. Some people have said that that occurred to him when it wasn't really applicable to his life. I don't know about that. You know, he was in a situation of violence. There was violence around him.
And there's a lot resting on that line.
At the end of the poem, the way it starts is, "Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests snug as a gun." It ends, "Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, I'll dig with it."
Yeah.
So you see a whole career following from that. But my point was that, you know, there's a very blatant, obvious connection he's making here, and these become brilliant and transcendent in his later work.
Yeah.
And he'll make a connection that he doesn't even have to make it like that, and suddenly it's full of these spiritual ramifications. And he achieved that early on in some of those middle books and Field Work and The Hall Lantern, and he's developed it further as he's gone on.
Well, and he circles back to the pen in a very recent poem called The Conway Steward, which is a poem about a pen that his parents gave him when he was leaving for college. So I just love the way Seamus Heaney always circles back to those formative and very deep experiences.
It's a career with great integrity in all the meanings of those words, and meaning it feels very much of a whole, but it has integrity too. You know, in the middle of his life, he said that he was headed towards one kind of life of a poet. He had a job as a teacher. He was really thriving, doing, you know, living on getting translations and doing things. And he said that he had to put himself more at risk, right? And he went, he's written about this. He went off to a cabin, I forget where, but where he wrote those sonnets in, mm-hmm. in field work. Mm-hmm. Glanmore must have been, because they're the Glanmore sonnets.
Right. Well, lucky to have him. He's still digging with that pen.
That was Christian Wyman and Don Scheer, the editors of Poetry Magazine. Now we'll hear an interview recorded live at the Poetry Prom 2010, organized by the Poetry Trust. You can find more podcasts on the Poetry Channel at thepoetrytrust.org. Here is Seamus Heaney speaking with poet Michael Lasky.
Thank you very much.
Seamus, the epigraph to Singing School, you quote the prelude, "I grew up, fostered alike by beauty and by fear, much favoured in my birthplace." Could you perhaps tell us a little about your birthplace?
Well, it was in the country, in South Derry. Typical small farm, but 40 acres. Thatched house, one story, stable at one end. So actually, I've always thought of my life as, first of all, the memory basis in County Derry, in a farm called Moss Bawn. It's packed in there, vacuum sealed. And then in my 20s, I began to write, and the little sigh of the tobacco thing opened up.
So your early education, this was in the village school?
Yeah, it was a country school. We walked about a mile to school. It was in two Nissen huts. The actual old school had been knocked down to make room for the aerodrome at the beginning of the war. So I went to these Nissen huts in 1945. They were still using the old forms where you sat in rows and there were inkwells and pens. In fact, it's given me a great attraction to using ink ever since, fountain pens and so on.
Then you won a scholarship to go to St. Columb's College in Derry?
Yes, that was a moment of change, definition, I suppose, a difference. I was the eldest of nine, and on, I think it was about the 30th of August, 1951, a car pulled up on the street belonging to a friend of my father's, Jim McKenna, who was a cattle dealer also. My father, my mother, and myself got into it and drove to Derry. And both they and I knew that something different was happening. And I think that that was the real moment of change. Then, of course, getting a scholarship to the university, of course, getting a degree at the university, and then going on to be a school teacher. And after that, going on to be a teacher in a training college, and after that, going on to teach in Queen's University, where I had only lately graduated as a student. So I was upwardly mobile from the, the beginning.
You tell a nice story in Stepping Stones about a first piece of writing that you did called The Day at the Seaside.
Oh, yes. Well, this was at the Nissen Hut School. We were asked to write a composition, as it was then called, an essay, on a day at the seaside. And I knew exactly what you were meant to do at the seaside. And so I had bought a bucket and spade, and I had swum, and of course I couldn't swim. My mother thought buckets and spades were catch pennies. So what she did, she bought us each a wooden spoon, which we could dig in the sand, but she could take the wooden spoon home afterwards and use it in the kitchen. So I covered up on the wooden spoon and wrote about the colourful buckets and spades and so on.
You got all the detail.
Later on in life that the wooden spoon is the real thing, you know. It's the interesting part. So I got the wooden spoon at the end.
So first poetic influences, first poems that you loved?
The first poems that I loved were probably rhymes, like local rhymes. Too late shall be the cry. The Bilahi bus goes sailing by. Actually, the older I've got, the more I respect it. It's got all kinds of sadness and elegy in it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But of course, in school, I learned poetry, and serious poetry, in elementary school before the age of 12. season of mists and mellow fruitfulness, close bosom friend of the maturing sun, conspiring with him how to load and bless with fruit the vines. So that was all there.
Your first book, The Death of the Naturalist, came from this period, didn't it, in your life, really?
Yeah, absolutely.
So just give us a feeling of this life. Perhaps you could read Digging.
Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade, just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow a man like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it. Thank you very much.
You've given an awful lot of readings. Were you always comfortable with poetry readings?
When I listened to myself early on, my voice is very highly pitched, and I gradually learned to slow down. I remember the Scottish poet Ian Crichton Smith said to me, after I read a poem called Moss Bawn Sunlight, he said to me, "You're a very slow poet," he said. And I learned to bring it down to my own natural speaking voice and to keep the accent of the place. And I'm sure that had to do with listening to Ted Hughes read. For I thought in his reading, his Yorkshire voice was retained. And the accent in the sense of the meter rhythm, the given cadence was retained. And the clarity of articulation, which came with his change from Yorkshire to Cambridge and London. That clarity of articulation was there, but it was allied to a regional type accent. And that seemed to me to give the readings a terrific authenticity. And he, of course, he was a magical reader. The voice was a tremble and could cast a spell, really.
Although you're Ulster born and bred, you've always felt more Irish than British.
Yeah.
Yes?
But that is possible in Ulster. Ulster is in Ireland, and... but of course, it's also in Britain. That was part of what we grew up in, with, through, by, grew up against in the end, grew up to grow against it. Yes. And in a sense, what I think our generation of poets did, James Simmons, Michael Longley, Derek Mahon, then later on, Kieran Carson, Paul Muldoon, Maeve McGaughey. And we saw the fact that we were poets together. We saw that this sectarian thing did not operate. We understood it completely, but we were able to understand it as a condition.
Do you think, looking back on it, that the poetry may have helped in the Troubles?
Well, it helped something. It helped the poets. It helped poetry, I think. There was good poetry written. We say the Troubles, we're talking about a period from 1968 until 1994, and at the same time, we're not talking about 150 years of sectarian life before that, and from the plantation of Ulster on, from the 1620s, we aren't talking about that. This is the end of a long condition, And Conor Cruise O'Brien, who was no friend of the Provisional IRA, but Cruise O'Brien said at the beginning of the business in Derry in 1968, he says, this isn't a matter of changing an election anomaly or a gerrymandering situation. It's a matter of changing the relationship between the victorious and the defeated, which is quite a difficult job.
Yes. So,
enough of that, maybe.
All right, so the life of the poet. Rilke said, you must change your life. Have you changed your life?
Well, once, certainly. When we went from the north to County Wicklow, I was the age of 33. I resigned my job in the university. I was very happy in Queen's. It was a good department, and I had very good friends. But I had published, at that stage, three books, and the books had been well received. And I didn't feel, however, that I had become a poet, whatever that meant. I had written poems, and I had put together collections, and I had the excitement of feeling, the joy of feeling that you've something has been done that is you and is different from you. But I think to say you are a poet, you have to earn it in some sort of way. That was my feeling anyway. It came to a moment when I thought you should commit yourself. So we were offered a cottage in County Wicklow, and I gave myself a job to translate a Middle Irish text, Bolu Sivne. And I had started on poems for a book called North. And I ended up there for 4 years. Then there was a family was older and the schooling had to start, so we moved back into Dublin. But that was one definite change.
So here you are. You're a great celebrity. I wonder how you cope with that. How hard is it to balance the responsibilities, your public responsibilities, with the responsibilities to live your own life?
Well, that I wonder about that myself, actually, constantly. I was in the teaching profession. I was going around conferences. I was going to schools to talk to kids. I was going to teacher courses and so on. So my formation was of that kind of serviceable nature to the profession. Then readings came along in the 60s, 70s, 80s. It just became a rhythm. And it probably got too much, all right, I agree, yeah.
So what would you say you needed to keep private, keep intact for yourself?
Well, the house that we rented for 4 years, I always felt that we had reneged on something when we went for the family's sake, for education's sake, to Dublin. But by great good luck, we were able to buy that cottage in 1988. And it came at a time when I was beginning to feel a bit overwhelmed. Our own house was becoming a combination of telephone exchange and travel agency. So this house, no phone, nobody in it except ourselves, and it has remained so. It's a secret and safe place.
I wondered, can you say what poetry's for? How does it make a difference? What's its value?
Well, I can only speak as a reader. I think it strengthens your inwardness. It's a kind of steadying of consciousness generally for the culture. A shared history of poetry running from Beowulf down through Chaucer, down through Wordsworth, down through Eliot, down to our own generation. The sense of a layered culture and consciousness is there in that. But I fundamentally think the purpose of poetry is to produce more poetry. Eliot called it sublime entertainment, didn't he? It must give pleasure, said Wallace Stevens. And Wordsworth talked about the grand elementary principle of pleasure. And that pleasure is different at different stages of your appreciation of it, I think.
Yes, so the last book, Human Chain, the new book,
yeah.
Has that been a difficult, painful book to write?
Well, it's been quite intimate. I wouldn't call it difficult to write. A lot of the poems were written quickly. If it had an epigraph, it would be an epigraph from Eliot. See, see, they depart, the faces and places, with the self which, as it could, loved them, to become renewed, transfigured, in another pattern. I think the older you get, you can look back at what happened to you and reprise. There's an element of reprise, I suppose, in this book.
Perhaps just to close, could you read the poem about the pen your parents gave you when you went away to college so that you could write to them?
Yeah, that day we left home and went to the college. We all went over the border to Buncrana in Donegal, which is a seaside resort, and I was bought a fountain pen, a Conwy Stewart fountain pen. So this goes back to that moment. It's kind of digging, revisited in a different sort of way. The Conwy Stewart. Medium, 14-carat nib. 3 gold bands in the clip-on screw top. In the mottled barrel, a spatulate, thin pump-action lever, the shopkeeper demonstrated, the nib uncapped, treating it to its first deep snorkel in the newly opened ink bottle. Guttery, snottery, letting it rest then at an angle to ingest, giving us time to look together and away from our parting due that evening to my long hand, dear to them, next day. Thanks very much.
That was Seamus Heaney speaking with Michael Lasky. Their conversation was part of the Poetry Prom, which took place on August 26, 2010, at Snape Maltings Concert Hall in Suffolk. The recording was kindly provided by the Poetry Trust, which sponsored the event in partnership with Oddborough Music. Seamus Heaney has written more than a dozen books of poetry, from Death of a Naturalist, published in 1966, to Human Chain, published in 2010. He is also active as a translator of poetry from Irish and other languages, and is the editor of poetry anthologies. You can read more about Seamus Heaney and some of his poems at poetryfoundation.org. You'll also find many other articles about poets and poetry, an online archive of more than 9,000 poems, and other audio programs to download. I'm Ed Herman. Thanks for listening to Poetry Lectures from poetryfoundation.org.